Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Park.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California today. And my co-host, Bob, is off on assignment, but will be rejoining us for future episodes, I'm sure. And today we're going to be actually talking about a topic that we've actually had some recent shows on. About 2 months ago, we had a noted organizer, activist, historian, Jeremy Brecher, to talk about building a labor and climate movement. And so now we're going to be actually talking about that again today. Today, we're joined by Norman Rogers, who is the second vice president of the United Steelworkers Local 675 down in Southern California. And then Jeff Ordower, who is the North America director of 350.org. Jeff is also a co-founder of the Green Workers Alliance and a member of the Rising Tide North America Collective. And then he's the co-editor with Lindsay Zafir of Power Lines, which is a new anthology about building a labor climate justice movement. And Norm actually is one of the, I think maybe the first chapter in the book, or maybe it's the second chapter. But we're going to be talking a little bit about how the corporate elite have long pitted labor movements against each other through this narrative of jobs versus the environment. But over the last few years, unions and climate organizers have been pushing back against this. So I just want to say welcome to Green and Red, to the Green and Red podcast, Norman. And then I also want to say, Jeff, welcome back to the Green and Red podcast.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a while.
Yeah. Maybe we can kick off with a question about the book, and I'll let whoever wants to go first sort of decide. But, you know, why don't you tell us a little bit about the main point of the book. What is it you're trying to do with the book, both with your chapter, Norman, and then Jeff as the sort of as the co-editor? And maybe we'll start with Norman.
The quick version is Jeff asked if I would write something. Okay. So I wrote something, but the hope is that, or the hope was and the hope remains that it shows the conversations can be had, that it takes a lot of work, but it's a difficult subject because we're letting folks know that what's coming on the horizon doesn't look good for us, and we can either be out in front of it or get run over by it. And there's vested interests to have us not take a clear-eyed view at things and prepare ourselves for what's coming next. They'd have us stay on with what we're doing for as long as possible. Then when the day comes, pull the plug, say thank you, and see you later. And then we're left wondering what comes next, as opposed to preparing ourselves and actively seeking out what's coming next, having a say in how that's going to play out, and be much better prepared than what we've seen happen when coal contracted, when the steel industry contracted, when the auto industry contracted, and what was left in its aftermath.
Yeah, and for me, it's both and. You know, I got my start as a professional organizer in the labor movement. That was a long time ago now, probably, I guess it's getting close to 30 years ago, organizing cafeteria workers and janitors and the Dallas Independent School District and in other school districts in Texas without collective bargaining rights, where you just had to fight the boss. And done a lot of work, as Scott, as you mentioned, both in my day job and with a lot of other work, you know, fighting against climate change, fighting to eliminate coal, sort of moving in direct action and organizing spaces in the climate movement. And the cool thing is, right, in Lindsay and I getting the chance to write this book, is we got to call comrades and people we knew well and people we didn't know so well to be like, you're doing brilliant work. You have interesting things that you're doing at the intersection of climate and labor and the industrial policy that we need to get there. And so will you write something? Because we think people will want to read it. And so this is an anthology. There's not one central thesis. There are some learnings that we have, but really this was like some of the coolest labor organizing, climate organizing, thinking about how we get where we need to go. And as Norman said, this is about, and you said, Scott, right, this is really about, you know, there's a small number of plutocrats that are trying to control the world, which is related to money, you know, racial monopoly capitalism, if you will. And if you work your way backwards from that, their interest is keeping people divided, that workers should have different interests than folks who are active on climate change, when in fact, you know, we're all workers and we're all fighting climate change. And so how do we bring that together? And what are some real case studies in where those things have been successful? What are learnings? Like in so many of the chapters, it's not just like, we're not trying to say this is easy, but really what people learned. And what I think what's so compelling is folks write about the mistakes they made and what they learned from them. And that's really for what we want people to learn and read is as organizers to learn from the mistakes and not be afraid to make them, because you're going to make some mistakes, but also, or they might not be mistakes. If you didn't do that set of things, if you didn't test that hypothesis, you wouldn't get to where you are now. So to give folks the impetus to do the work, whether you're doing labor organizing, whether you're doing climate organizing, whether you're at the intersection of that.
There is a number of chapters in the book which talk about this overlap between climate justice. I mean, there's a big theme of environmental justice and climate justice, even in the sort of introduction that's written by you and Maya from the Asia Pacific Environmental Network. But, you know, we've really seen a lot of sort of movement on sort of merging, you know, these two movements, I guess you could say. And I'm wondering, with that sort of environmental justice, climate justice frame, you know, what do you see as like the challenges that have been going on, and if anything of that emerges in the book?
I think what is an emerging theme is the boss is going to lie, right? This isn't just Norman's chapter, like, you know, thinking about, let's say, Veronica Coptis's chapter around the Center for Coalfield Justice, where they invited the workers to call them, even though they disagreed about the issues around mining, because the organization was going to say, you might not agree with us, but we're going to give you the accurate information. We know the coal company's permits. We know what they're going to do and what they're not going to do. So we may disagree because you want to keep mining and we don't, but we're a good faith place for information. So I think like so much of this is just telling each other the truth and building those relationships and being willing to steer into that conflict. I think that's really important. And I think that's an ongoing theme. And I guess I would take a step back because I've been organizing for 30 years. I think, and because social media and is so pervasive now that people think if they've said a thing, that's more important than if they've done a thing. And what the theme emerges is we're putting people together in space, so many of these chapters, to not just build relationships, but lean into the struggle, figure out where there's common interest, figure out where there's disagreement, see if we can move forward. I think that is the lost art of organizing, is really being able to lean into uncertainty, let folks argue it out, hash it out, learn from each other, build those relationships when you don't know what the answer is going to be, but you have to trust, whether you're doing environmental justice or climate justice organizing or worker organizing, that the members are smart and that the members know more than we do, and that you have to trust people's ability to make decisions. And, you know, I know it's green and red, so I can say this. The bullshit that the boss is feeding or the bullshit the corporation's feeding is not what is real, but what's real is folks telling the truth to each other and then moving forward together.
And Norman, as someone who's, you know, been working on the ground, you're part of a steel worker local in Southern California, which I believe works at an oil refinery. There's, you know, I'm familiar with a number of environmental justice fights and environmental justice groups down in Southern California. I'm wondering, as someone on the ground, you know, kind of picking up on this, you know, kind of narrowing down on the question I just asked Jeff, as someone on the ground, what are some of the challenges in which you've seen, particularly being in spaces with environmental justice, climate justice groups, or just straight up environmental groups too, right? Like there's also a whole divide between sort of, you know, what I would call like white-led environmental movements versus like environmental justice groups and communities on the ground.
So one of the things, and one of the main things, is that folks don't know fully what we're doing at the refinery. There's a lot of, I'll call it slop in the language, because we're talking about fossil fuels generally because we want to get rid of the internal combustion engine, but that's not everything that comes out of a barrel of oil. That's one piece. Another piece, the picture behind me, I used that. That's Huntington Beach, California, 100 years ago. And I use it as an example. If you picture each one of those derricks as a household, we're asking for them to give up their source of income. And then that collection of derricks is a community, it's a county, it's a municipality. Because we, as one would expect, we have clusters of folks that live around the refineries. And so there's a high degree. We've had 100 years of collective bargaining. So we have good contracts. We've had good contracts. These jobs have been held by, I've worked with folks where it's the third generation that's held these jobs. And so I give that, explain some of that, and some of what's going to happen next is the loss of revenues for cities and municipalities. And then it starts being an issue with being able to fund for fire departments, police departments, libraries, having a pizza party after a soccer match, that these are the impacts. And so that understanding has gone a long way for folks and how they approach it. And then also there's the piece that that we're all painted, everybody in the refinery is painted with the same paintbrush. There's folks that work inside the refineries that understand the situation and the challenges that we're facing climate-wise. But on the other hand, is if we look at what happened with solar panel installation and what a terrible, terrible outcome there's been there, as far as they're just dirt poor paying jobs, the alternatives to what folks are currently doing isn't there. And so then you're going to hold on to the paycheck you know you've had for the last 200 years. They've never bounced a check. And versus what we hear is green jobs, and we don't know what that is. So The word transition is used, but that would seem to suggest there's somewhere to go. So when we look to see where there is to go, there isn't anything. And so then people just hold on to what they know. And ultimately, this is all a jobs issue. You know, folks say green jobs will retrain people. Okay, I lose my job on Friday. On Monday, I go to retraining. I finish up my training on that Friday. What then?
Right.
So that's where it becomes a jobs thing. And we're not seeing it. So there's hesitance on people's, nobody is born on the planet wanting to work in a refinery. There's high temperatures, high toxic chemicals, high pressures. If there's something else to do, we'll do it. But it doesn't seem to be there. And then there's a grander scale. If you picture an elevator and there's 50 people in the elevator and California's in the middle and we're there taking off a sweater. So we're throwing elbows everywhere. And the policies that have been enacted, that's us throwing elbows to the person in Ohio or Indiana that makes carburetors, or that makes catalytic converters or mufflers, because we don't need any of those things for electric cars. So they see the same issue as, and then it becomes a ballot box issue. Do I vote to keep the job I have, or do I vote for the environment? And that's where it becomes that either or thing. But it doesn't have to be that way, but it hasn't been shown what's next. And so those are the discussions I've had with our folks, and then also with the environmental folks. And so that's helped make for a better atmosphere for discussions to take place, because it's just the right thing to do historically has been to keep a roof over your head and food on the tables. And now the right thing, there's an alternate version of the right thing, which is to give up your job for the climate.
These green jobs are so illusory. Like, you're what's the life of a wind turbine technician, for example? It's temporary work predominantly. These are staffing agencies, right? These aren't even, it's not even you're working for the company. It's a shell game. So you go and you're in Virginia, and then you get a call to go work in Texas or Wyoming, and you drive across country, and while you're waiting, borrowing money from family and friends, and you're sleeping in your car until your per diem kicks in. Like, this is really, really tough conditions versus what Norman's talking about, a steady paycheck. And I think we juxtapose them, and things are hard, right? We're seeing this workers, less than 6% or 6% of the private sector is unionized now in the US, right? Even we're seeing some uptick in union organizing, but it's not sufficient to create the union density. The percentage of workers that are in unions, it is still extremely, extremely hard to organize new workplaces. And many of the corporations try to get around it by using subcontractors, temp agencies, gig work, all of those kinds of things that we know about that make it harder for workers to get the contracts that they fought for 100 years ago and won.
Putting the factories in right to work states, I would imagine, would be a big another big one as well.
Well, if I may, real quick, about putting factories in right to work states, there was a company named Proterra, electric bus company, sought us out to say because there was contracts that were available to them if they had a unionized workforce. So we said yes. We went in, got contracts signed. They got money from the state of California. We helped them with that, and they built. So we were working under that for a couple of years, having some trouble because despite having community benefit agreements, they were slow to act on them. The January, late January of last year, they said, "Hey, we're going to have a meeting about the course of the company come moving forward." And that meeting was to say, "We're closing up shop here and moving to South Carolina." They had taken the money that the state of California had given them, and they built a facility in South Carolina. And the California Energy Commission, thinking they were doing the right thing, is they gave the money, and things were going well enough. But they built a new facility. They fired everybody. It's 100 people who thought that they were in on the ground floor of something good because electrification, electric buses turned out their battery packs were very, very popular. So they started focusing more on that. But then the whole thing was a scam. They closed up shop and moved back to South Carolina. And when we were trying to negotiate, the separation agreement, and we asked, well, can folks here get preferential treatment when they hire? Well, no, we don't need that. They can just put down on their resume that they worked here, and we'll see that. So that combined with how things have played out with solar, when those are the like chief examples right now of what a green job is, so it makes it a difficult sell.
Right. So bosses, whether it's over some sustainable form of energy
Oh
or
yeah. No,
they act the same, right?
they take the Velcro off oil company and then throw on the new label and say electric bus, but there's still dicks at the top.
My question that I was going to ask is how much the state of California is like really pushing for more electric vehicles and like a rollback of the internal combustion engine. And I was wondering what the impacts of that were within, within like your local, within just the people that that you work with and organize with.
Right now, it still seems like something that's down the road a ways. And then there's a fair bit of skepticism as well, because getting back to that slop in the language between we keep talking about fossil fuels and not petroleum products, we know that there's more involved on a barrel of oil of just fossil fuels. I just spoke at the California Climate Center policy meeting earlier this week, And I showed a picture from the state of California scoping plan. And that picture showed there was two electric vehicles and there was a hydrogen truck. And I asked people in the crowd, I said, well, what do you see? And they said, oh, well, there's, electric vehicles, a couple of electric vehicles, and there's a hydrogen truck. No internal combustion engines. And I told them, well, what I see is asphalt that they're parked on. I see synthetic rubber in the tires on those vehicles. I see vehicles that are about 20% plastic, and I see paint. All of that comes out of a barrel of oil. And so, again, it's that slop in the language that we're not clearly looking at the whole thing so we can make better policy decisions. So that gets back to folks in the refinery going, this isn't going to happen on the timeline that's predicted, and it's not going to work out in the way it's predicted, because we're not looking at the whole barrel of oil. We're in a spot too, where we have a lot of older folks that are ready to retire. So they'll go out and say, you know, see, it's been good. Younger folks will have to see what happens. There's still a little bit of, it's way off in the distance just yet. California has put some money for it, though. We did get originally it was a $40 million displaced oil and gas worker fund. It got knocked down to $30 million because of budget issues we're having here in California. So that's a good sign. And then there's money that's been set aside for oil and gas well capping. And LA City and LA County have come together for a just transition task force to help plan the closing of idle and orphaned wells. So there's good things happening on the scale that's needed. I think not, but given the example I gave earlier about folks in Indiana and Ohio seeing their jobs impacted this very quickly, it makes it a federal issue, and there's no federal guidance on what we're doing next. So
I'm kind of curious about how, like, industry lobby groups, front groups, like the Western States Petroleum Association, which is, you know, has a lot of sway, at least within the state government, a lot more than people realize. I'm wondering how much they're trying to connect with the steel workers, how much they're trying to connect with labor.
They're able to go in and find workers that will go and speak on their behalf, and go, I'm in Southern California. I'm an hour and a half flight away from Sacramento. We're trying to come up with a coherent state policy for USW refineries. And some of the items are in line with WISPA and some of them aren't. But the folks that live closer to Sacramento, they're able to be there more for lobby days and things like that. And so WISPA will not promote, what's the word? Will help initiate those lobby days.
Right. And then I also saw that you've been involved with a group called California Labor for Climate. Is that right?
CLCJ, California Labor for Climate Jobs, yes.
Yeah, Climate Jobs. And I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that.
It's a coalition of unions. There's ourselves, United Auto Workers. We have, about 14 or 15 different unions that are there to shape policy and legislation that helps towards there being a place for labor as a climate legislation comes through, and what's coming next, that workers have a seat at the table.
What's important there for us to understand is, you know, we use, to Norman's point about slopping the language, I think it's the same thing on labor and climate. Like, we say, oh, labor thinks this. Labor is not a monolith, right? There's lots of unions that are thinking towards the future. There are lots of unions that are, you know, thinking towards the past. There are unions that are more broad, you know, that are mobilizing unions, like we've seen with the auto workers recently, that are moving in an incredibly transformative way, that see themselves as, you know, shoulder to shoulder with folks in a more contentious, cantankerous fight against capital. And so I think we don't often look at, we sort of throw bandy about terms, the labor movement, or, and then for us in the climate movement, the same thing, right? There's a big difference between the Environmental Defense Fund and the Sunrise Movement or 350.org. And we need to understand that and have some awareness. And I'm not saying everyone needs to be in a, you know, do a whole power analysis, but you, but I think sometimes we shy away from doing a little bit of the work that we need to do to be like, actually, what do we know about this? And we do a much better job of, let's say, researching a politician that we're going to meet with than we do in thinking about, can we talk to this union or can we talk to this climate group and what are they going to think?
Yeah. And to go back to the question earlier about speaking to environmental groups, another piece to that is to not get upset and annoyed because there's no reason for them to know any of this. There's no reason for them to know what it is that happens at a refinery or to particularly know what's in their tennis shoes or what's in a syringe. There's just no reason. So there's frustration and there's anger, these effing environmentalists, this and that. But there's why would they know? Why would they know? And labor's not taught in school anymore, at least the way it was when I grew up. And you don't see the head of the AFL-CIO on the golf course with the president anymore. And all the major newspapers used to have a labor section in it, and you don't see that anymore. So there's no reason for anyone to know, unless you come from a labor household.
Right. Or you're an activist who follows various labor efforts on social media, such as myself.
That was the problem, is that it was both labor hit a zenith when, you know, a George Meteor, old head of the Labor Federation, had played golf with the president. But because it was he played golf, that might have been a problem in the first place.
You are listening to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. Please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, please hit that subscribe button. And if you're listening to us on your favorite audio platform, please give us a rate and review. It helps us with the algorithms. And if you really like what you're hearing, please go to our Patreon, patreon.com/greenredpodcast, and become a patron or make a one-time donation by going to our website at greenandredpodcast.org and hitting that support button. I have some other questions about the sort of where the movements are and how they're like interacting. But I actually, before I wanted to do that, because I think an important thing to kind of get into and talk with the audience about is just transition. And so that's a word that gets thrown out a lot. Sometimes to me, it feels like it's a buzzword, and I know it's an important process and it's an important piece of all of this. And so maybe I'll probably ask both of you to kind of give some a little bit of background on here, but maybe Norman if you could actually start with a little bit of just a background on just transition.
Okay, so we have to go back quite a few years. There was a gentleman named Tony Mazzocchi. And before we were the United Steelworkers, we were a union called the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, all the good stuff. And Tony Mazzocchi led that. And he was seeing that his workers under his care were being exposed to all kinds of different chemicals, stuff that was just nothing but hazardous. And so between that and that's about the time the Superfund started coming up to clean up old sites where that contaminated work sites. And there was all this money pouring in to clean up those sites, to clean up the dirt, essentially. And the term came up, you know, well, treat us like dirt. You know, spend the money on us that you're spending on the dirt so that we can move into other jobs, that we can transition to other jobs, that there's a just transition away from what we've been dealing with into something else. And that's where the term first came from. And so that's the history of that. And there was another part to your question.
And Tony Mazzocchi actually was with refinery workers down in Southern California, right? Yeah, like he has roots down where you are.
So he started in the East Coast, I believe, I forget what union he was with. Shame on me. Or not what union, but what local he was and what the industry was where he worked. But, you know, there's so much in so many different areas where there's just bad actors as far as chemicals and products that we're exposed to and supposed to use, that it kind of bridges over whether you come from a refinery or whether you're working in a mine or whether you're painting radioactive paint on the faces of watches. It's all bad stuff.
And why do you think just transition is important for effective climate action?
It's, well, so it gets back to the piece about jobs, that if we will net more help and a greater number of people and a greater voice, that people know they don't have to make the choice between their jobs and a clean environment. And to the extent that folks don't end up with a place to go, don't have, they're not able to stay in their homes and feed their kids, then that puts up an obstacle towards things moving in the direction they need to move in. Again, folks are working, want to work, have been working, but what's been put out there right now isn't, it's not, well, no, it's on a strictly economic basis and looking after my family, which comes first. Unless there's a just transition, there's going to be a lot more difficulty in getting things to where they need to be. Excuse me.
And Jeff, you know, there's a chapter in the book where you interview Jose Bravo, who's the director of the Just Transition Alliance, who works with a lot of communities. And I'm just wondering if there's anything, particularly from that chapter or that interview with Jose, and I've been actually meaning to have Jose on the show at some point in the future. But I'm wondering if there's anything just you want to add kind of based on that interview.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. I think Jose's chapter is...
I'm glad I was able to frame it as a question before you said it.
I mean, first of all, you know, just stating the obvious, right? Workers live in the community. So we're like forcing people into making, you know, making bad choices to feed their family when that's not where they're naturally inclined. And so I think what Jose Bravo's chapter talks about, and also, you know, talks about Tony Mizaki, is really thinking about how do you have a holistic approach, and how do you support and how do you do the work, because it's in a community where you're protecting families, where you're protecting workers, where you're doing that kind of work together around a holistic strategy. And I think that's what Just Transition is really thinking about the needs of the community, thinking about what community needs, and work is a piece of that, but also where kids go to school, also, you know, the cultural pieces of it. So it's not just, I think we think about things so much in clinical terms, or are we reducing carbon or not? And really it's a holistic approach that we're all in crisis because of the impacts of what's happening, and is increasingly harder to feed your family, to have sustainable and permanent work, to have the leisure that you need. People have two or three more jobs, to have the community that you need, to have the food that you need. And we're all sort of facing that together. And that's what Just Transition is. And I think Jose talks about that a lot in the chapters, building that and doing the work really over time to start to get there, to have the solidarity together where people are standing with each other around their struggles, and even having really hard conversations where you sometimes walk away, because that fight, you know, we really do build relationships in the work through struggle. And things are much stronger if you can come out the other side around disagreement and struggle. And I think that's critical. One other thing I want to say about Tony Mizaki is, you know, we're talking about labor leaders that were pretty visionary. So like, he helped start Labor Party Advocates. There was a bunch of work in the 80s and 90s, an iteration to start third parties, the recognition that the two-party system was insufficient. I feel like I should channel Bob, who's always, you know, critiquing the Democrats on the show, but like, these are folks who are, you know, 40 years ahead of their time around this. And so there really were elements that were coming out of labor that were very clear about what needed to happen and what needed to change in the country. It wasn't just about one piece of protecting the workers. It was a larger sense of what needed to happen and transform in the US.
Yeah, you're missing your we're missing our Pelosi bashing.
I need
Pelosi
foil
bashing
on
on the
that.
Green and Red podcast. We've talked about this a little bit already, but you know, an important strategy that the industry and capital has used has been jobs versus the environment. I come out of a lot of forest defense, grassroots forest defense, which is, you know, it was very much associated with, you know, the fight against the redwoods, but we've seen industry do this over and over. And it's actually even, it's in the first sentence of the blurb of the book, actually. The corporate elite have long pitted the climate and labor movements against each other through a jobs versus the environment narrative that maximizes profits. And I'm wondering if either of you have thoughts about how just transition is an important counter to that divisive strategy.
I think it's a little bit what I said before. It's a holistic piece of that. But I also think people get it and we don't create the space for that to happen. So about a little more than a decade ago now, 13, 14 years ago, I was helped start an organization in Missouri, Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment. And as part of our power map based in St. Louis, you know, what we're trying to do is not just win justice for people, but also contend for power, that there's worker power, that there's community power, that is countervailing force to corporate power. And in our analysis of St. Louis at the time, St. Louis was the only Fortune 500 company left within the city limits of St. Louis was Peabody Coal, the largest private coal company in the world. A lot of reasons, a lot of sort of macro reasons for that, right? Banks, you know, as banks merged, St. Louis became a branch office, or so many sort of mid-sized cities did. And so we decided we needed to fight Peabody for a number of reasons, right? For the work that they were doing in polluting communities, for the work that they had in a dirty environment, but also as the organization was being formed, I should also note as a successor organization to Acorn, which I think is an important part of my story, like something that listeners should, you know, should value that sort of set of rigorous organizing. But as we were building that organization and engaging in the fight, Peabody was also like, oh yeah, we need tax breaks from the schools for $60 million of new office equipment and office renovations. So they were starving the local community while at the same time pretending to support it. And so we engaged in a pretty, you know, intersectional fight against Peabody. And in this case, and Norman talked about this, type of the oil industry going and talking to workers around the union. But in this case, the leadership of the mine workers was still thinking about what their mutual interest was with the boss. But when we show workers more generally understood the fight. So first of all, when we were crashing the Peabody shareholder meetings to demand that they do different things, you know, the local AFL-CIO was with us. Lots of other unions were with us. When we went even to Wyoming, they moved the meeting, the shareholder meeting to Wyoming in the hopes that we wouldn't be there. Retired miners and climate folks were together. They were like, that's great, fight the boss. So I think people get it. Folks get the fight. And again, I think this gets into where I think there's perfectionism in organizing right now, that we think as organizers, we have to have the strategy all figured out, when really it's the experience of people sitting in a room and figuring things out together because we share an interest. We understand that the boss needs to be fought, that these coal companies need to be fought, that the, you know, private equity and banks need to be fought, then we'll figure it out together. And I think that's the framework for moving forward, is really engaging in shared struggle together. And that's really what Just Transition is going to look like, is us figuring it out. How are we going to provide for communities? What are the demands we need to make? What are the wins? As Norman pointed out, you know, $30 million for oil workers, not sufficient. But once you've opened that gate, then every year you can fight about how many millions of dollars more go to people so they can either be retrained or get an early retirement or get what they need to get. So I think it's, and those demands came not just from the unions demanding them, but I imagine from, you know, community groups and climate groups as well.
As we're creating those toeholds, which become footholds, which become a dam, you know, not to mix my metaphors, a dam burst, you know, how do you see the industry backlashing against that? I know within coal, at least within the United States, we've seen a big slide in their influence. We've hit peak coal, things like that. But what is the bash the backlash going to look like? And yeah, what is the backlash going to look like?
Yeah, I think it's going to be twofold. Well, first, there's going to be co-optation that's attempted too, right? If you talk to every
It's part
bank,
of the backlash, right?
yeah, fair enough. I mean, you know this as a corporate campaigner, Scott, for your day job that banks are like, no, we don't just fund coal, we now fund renewables, and we have a renewable portfolio, and we have a coal, we have a fossil fuel portfolio. So they're going to try to co-opt it, I think, is the first piece of the backlash. And then the second piece is what you're seeing with this, just the higher level of repression, repression against workers, repression against activists. Folks are fighting the Mountain Valley Pipeline right now in Virginia and West Virginia, getting felony charges, getting serious jail time, just sort of the chilling of the effects, even people preventing people from
Getting
taking.
sued, civil
Yeah.
suits.
That's right. The slap suits.
Yeah. So there's a Talking Heads song, Puzzling Evidence, and there's a line in it. They have the power of money and the money to buy it. And that's what it's been and what it's going to be. It'll be more of that. They've got enough money to make happen whatever it is they want to have happen. And so it just means we have to organize better. And if we have to organize better, and Jeff mentioned earlier that we have to get rid of the labor and the community, workers and the community. Workers are the community. Where the area here in Southern California, my refinery is in Carson. There's other refinery in Torrance. I have people that work at the Torrance refinery and live in Carson under another refinery. I have folks that work at the Carson refinery and live in Carson. So they are workers and they are the community. And so that needs to go away, just like environmental justice versus climate or versus climate justice. It's all one big mass, and it needs to be made that because it's the number of people, the number of voices that's going to get the change made. And, if it's to my mind that a conglomeration of all those different movements, it's summed up with there was the old saying is don't shit where you eat, but to expand that for a new generation, it's don't shit where you eat and don't shit where others eat. And I think that covers most of everything. And if we can move forward like that, the numbers of people, hopefully that we can mount meets the number of dollars that the oil companies can spend. Knowing at the end of all this, when the return on investment isn't really there, they're going to walk away from them. And what's that going to mean? That's another piece of just transition that needs to be looked at. That path to when the refineries are actually decommissioned, what it looks like leading up to decommissioning, where they're not putting the money in to keep them repaired and they become even more dangerous to operate. All of that is part of what needs to be looked at. And then what happens to people that live around these refineries now, once the refineries are gone and the area cleans up. And then the property taxes start going up because now it's more desirable. And now they can no longer afford to stay in their homes because we fixed the source of the pollution they were living next to. That's all in this. There's a big wide lens that needs to be used on all of this to truly make things right. And if we're doing that and we can speak to those things before folks have concerns and say, well, we've looked into that. This is what we found, or we've reached out and talked to folks on the ground, that shows we've done the work. And as Jeff said, we might not have points of view that folks agree with, but we do have the facts that are correct and that they can look them over for themselves. And then ultimately, getting back specifically to workers at the refinery, whatever it is we do, where we're inserting ourselves between someone and their paycheck, we need to be at least three steps ahead of them to explain what's going on, what's going to happen, and where the remedies are.
You're kind of getting into what my next, I have two questions left, as we're starting to kind of run short of time, and you're kind of getting into answering my first one, but just to kind of like put a frame this frame on it is, how do you see What do you see as the best strategies for creating enduring labor climate, you know, alliances or enduring climate labor movements, where it's this sort of like cooperative movement? And this maybe Norman, you can start, and then Jeff can share his thoughts.
Well, one of the things that we saw last year, maybe I guess it was 2022. Holy cow! All right, but we had a Chevron refinery in Richmond was on strike, and Greenpeace was out on the picket lines with us. So that's one way. Again, this goes back to conversations that have been had with Greenpeace about what we're facing, what's going on, and reaching an understanding and finding out that there's not ogres on the other side, that there's human beings, and that understanding of what's needed as we move forward goes a long way. And ultimately, everybody is a human being. And so the example comes to mind of the neutron bomb, because the neutron bomb, you know, it goes off, it kills people, but it leaves the building standing. And that's not an answer. So it's like, we don't want, everybody wants clean air. Everybody, when they retire, wants to be able to go up to the mountains and go fishing, and it's nice, and take the grandkids along to show them how to hook a worm and do all of that. And so it's not an either or thing. It's how best to make both things happen. It's not the what, it's the how. And that's what's going to lead to, I think, the longer term strengthened bonds between the two.
Yeah, and I think we saw this again with the auto workers last year too. So many folks, again, Greenpeace played a huge role, Labor Network for Sustainability. Two groups that had pieces in the book. We did 350. We did, you know, a lot of our members came out of the picket lines too with the auto workers, and what we saw has really helped bolster them. But I think the other thing I wanted to say is, so there's about being in the struggle together, and then there's about a vision for where we're trying to go, about the community, you know, and Norman talked about this and touched on this, but I really think that the vision of like how things could be different if we won is really important for us to dream together. And I think that's some of the magic of the work itself, is in engaging in struggle together, we're starting to build different relationships and really think about different things that we want to do and that we want to build. And so I think letting those relationships happen, not being scared to show up on a picket line or not being scared to come to a, you know, meeting or a climate protest, like we do, you know, I'm really repeating what Norman said, but just otherizing people, whereas both being together and not being afraid to dream about what could be different. Like what do it look like when we get through to the other side? I think that part is really, really important. And I think so many pieces of this, of the organizing that's featured here, are little glimpses of that, of like meeting people where they're at, organizing not in Spanish, but in Mixtec, or, you know, thinking about the picnics together, or giving the good faith. There's a whole lot of things that we can do that make the organizing fun and joyous, even in these very, very difficult times while it's a struggle, that start to envision the world in which we want to live. And I think that's really critical to the relationships we want. What does it look like if we really had power versus the crabs in a barrel? Like, we're both fighting and we need to just hang on to the little bits that we got.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to look at it. And it's nice to see that I feel like a vision is sort of comes out of the book. There's like, we see the vision, or at least parts of the vision, kind of emerging from your book. My last question, this is also a kind of a usual sort of green and red, because we're often in some sort of heated discussion with some other comrades in the left, is around false solutions to climate change. And so, you know, when we're looking at false solutions like nuclear power and carbon capture and storage, I'm wondering how you think that lands within this landscape of labor and climate organizing.
I don't know. There's so much that's being touted. I don't know what's real and what's not. There are false solutions. I mean, nuclear is problematic, but that's fission. If we get to fusion, then there's other discussions that need to be had then, but we're not there yet. So we know what the outcomes are. Folks say, yeah, it's non-polluting, but they're not looking what comes out the back end and how long the spent uranium is problematic. Carbon capture, again, I don't know. Then within that, there's carbon capture, and then there's carbon capture and storage, and then there's direct carbon capture where we're sucking it out of the air. Mm-hmm. Direct carbon capture would seem to make sense. However, the scale of what's possible now versus what's needed, it's not there. So I don't know. I don't know. A lot of things are getting touted, and there's money behind whatever it is that's being touted. I'm not enough of an expert to speak to that.
I want to follow up that to exactly your point, right? There's money behind it. There's like, oh, just give us some, you know, some arrogant tech bro or billionaire is going to be like, oh, just for $1 billion, we'll figure out how to suck carbon out of the atmosphere, or, you know, safe storage of nuclear waste. It'll only go away after 1 million years. It's good for your community. So these are real. I think we don't want to face, and it's not just because we're saying, oh, it's hard choices that we'd have to change a lot of the way our society is organized. We have to have fewer cars and more mass transit. We have to, you know, have a lot more local, or, you know, food, less transport of food. I mean, those are all things that we want to have. Like, we want to have more leisure, less work, be rooted more in community. So the vision of where we're trying to go is actually the vision for what we want to be. Like, we're not trying to emulate a society right now where people have three jobs or where, and so that is both a fight and that's a vision. And it is going to involve some, you know, I mean, at Rising Tide, we used to say, you know, capitalism is, or, you know, we still say capitalism is the problem and climate change is a symptom of that. And so we are trying to change things fundamentally. And we should be honest and clear about that. Because that also gets us to someplace more interesting. And false solutions is just a way to be like, you can have everything you have right now. You don't have to change a thing because science solved the problem.
Yeah, and, or technology solves the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm actually not interested in figuring out how to create more renewable energy so like people can mine for more Bitcoin. That's really not the thing we should be doing right now.
We're just anti-science, I'm sure. I'm sure that's what the problem is.
Well, I thought, I was trying to think back when the first Earth Day was, and I remember vividly being in the fourth grade, and it's like, okay, very good. Makes sense. No more pull tops on cans of Coke and, you know, all of that, and we'll pick up trash when we see it, and we'll recycle it, and we'll be good. And I thought, oh, we must be coming up on the 50th anniversary of the first Earth Day. Well, we're coming up on the 54th anniversary. And things that I heard growing up, I don't longer hear anymore. I don't hear about conservation, don't hear about population growth. All of that's gone by the wayside. And if we don't use it, it won't get made. But we use it. So, I don't know. Grumble, grumble.
I want to say it's individual choices, and it's really choices we're making as society. And the way we combat that and create a more collectivist atmosphere is by being in struggle together, by getting together and organizing and doing that, not by this atomized, balkanized society.
Yeah. Yeah. The individual behavior is not going to solve it. It has been great.
Although we can stop the individual behavior of the people running around in private jets, what, 3,300 private jets at the Super Bowl? That's some individual behavior. That's some shit we need to stop.
Well, no, I'm pretty down to stop that type of individual behavior, but we have to do it through collective action. So
that's right.
Yeah, that's the important piece of the collective action versus the individual behavior. I don't care how popular Taylor Swift is and how much she's going to help us defeat Trump, whatever. She still needs to stop flying in private jets. And I'm sure I'll get a lot of heat from the Swifties for saying that. Y'all, it's been great talking. Folks, we've been talking with Norman Rogers, who's a steel worker down in Southern California, and Jeff Ordower, who works with 350, is the co-founder of the Green Workers Alliance, is a member of the Rising Tide Collective. This is the book, Power Lines, that he co-edits with Lindsay Zafir. Has a lot of, it's a really great little book, has lots of good chapters with a lot of, in particular, a lot of interesting perspectives about how climate justice, climate, you know, environmental justice can work together with labor and with communities. We'll put a link to it in the show notes so you can go out and buy a copy immediately. And I want to thank you all for joining us today. I think this has been a really great conversation today. And for folks listening, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Hit subscribe on YouTube. And if you're listening to us on the platforms, give us a rate and review. The audio platforms, give us a rate and review. And if you really like us, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit the support button and make a donation or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. There may be a patron of the Green and Red Podcast on the show right now. I'm just going to throw that out there. And
everyone wants to be one.
Yeah, everybody wants to be one. Jeff was maybe our first one, actually, now I think about it. One of our first ones. And so everyone else, go out and make trouble and misbehave, and we'll talk to you again really soon.